Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories. Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby, campus community radio from Simon Fraser University. I'm Jesse, and on the phone with me are Ella and Arie. Hello.
Hello.
We have been talking about Black in BC Mutual Aid and the Emergency Black Community COVID-19 Fund. I realized before, while that song was playing, it was CC by Tanya Aganaba, that we didn't provide any information about where people can go to support or find out more information. So let's do that right off the top.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you for referring back to this. But our GoFundMe, which we're actually collecting funds on for the fund, you can find us on GoFundMe if you search Black in BC Community Support Fund for COVID-19. Right now, that's the only space in which we are kind of doing this work. But for folks that may be Black in the community that are looking for connection during this time, specifically during the time of the pandemic, we do have a Facebook group set up for Black folks in BC that also serves as a mutual aid network. So you can find us on Facebook, same name, Black in BC Mutual Aid. And there's a couple questions to fill out, identifying if you're Black, identifying why you want to be a part of the group. But for Black folks in BC, that's a space that you can go to. We'll have social media put up in the next little bit. But for right now, you can find us on the GoFundMe.
Okay, and I'll link to that GoFundMe and as well to the Facebook group. If you can pass me that link, I'll put those in the show notes so that people who are listening can go to cgsf.ca and find that as well. Getting my bearings here. Oh, also, once you have social media, I'd love to have you back on the show to talk about that and spread the word some more. So
thank you.
Set a future date. Let's pivot now to one of the asks, or I guess a series of asks, but the open letter sent to Premier John Horgan, Health Minister Adrian Dix, and Dr. Bonnie Henry, and the Vancouver City Council about disaggregated race-based data collection in BC. Maybe the best way to approach this is maybe defining some terms, I guess. When we say disaggregated race-based data collection, what does that mean or look like for the city and the province?
To put it as simple as possible, it's collecting data that is aware of the what's the term? That is aware of the like racial aspects that go into the systems that we exist in. So when we're asking for the collection of race-based data, it specifically has to do with putting a magnifying glass on how the lack of race-based data that we have already makes it hard and is inadequate for us to collect data that's all like that actually feeds into who we are as individuals. I know us both being Black plays into a lot of how we exist in this world. If we had race-based data specifically within this pandemic, specifically during COVID-19, we would be able to figure out how to support our communities better, because then we would be able to highlight the different racial biases and the different language barriers that permeate healthcare at every level, and that have a specific impact on us as Black people. So that call for aggregated race-based data is just a call to actually acknowledge that our lived experiences have to be tied into the data as well.
Right, because I mean, it's the All Lives Matter argument again, right? Yeah. Where that like we are in such a data centric, like we all want to be making data-driven decisions, but if the data doesn't exist, then you can't make the decisions. And by saying that everyone is the same and there's no need for specific data that notes difference and notes how the system notices difference and uses difference and abuses difference, you can't advocate for change, and you can't make the change if you don't have the information.
Exactly. So in our call, in our letter out, we talk about how we need the collection of race-based data to see what the health, financial, and like societal impacts on Black folks and of Black folks, and not only Black people, right? All racialized people in Canada, how we need to have that data in order to to be able to build up systems that adequately support Black people. One of my inspirational humans of my life is June Francis, and June Francis is actually the director of the Institute of the Diaspora Research and Engagement at SFU. And the way that she put it is that she said, in Canada, the lack of data means public health officials are flying blind. And I love that quote because I feel like it really puts into context kind of where we're at, where something like this GoFundMe, which is a beautiful mutual aid, community organized, community backed thing, is really sitting in replacement of what we could have if we had the race-based data.
Mm-hmm.
If that makes any sense.
Totally. Well, and it's like, once again, it's the community having to come together to fill these gaps because the government, various levels of government, have not taken the time or care to put in the work to learn what needs to be done.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
So do you have recommendations or ideas for the implementation of this?
Well, currently we put out some we put out ways in which that we urge the province of BC to take action on health inequalities. So specifically from this, we asked, one, mandating the collection, use, and analysis of disaggregated social, demographic, and race-based data in health and social science sectors, which would mean that we collect this data and we analyze it and we use it in order to really look at how race-based data plays in our health and in our social sciences. And two, we ask to ensure that the collection of data is led to critical race researchers who identify as having racialized identities and experiences to ensure that the data collection measures meaningfully contribute to building a culturally safe healthcare system and is not used for any other purposes. So in that, we ask that the collection of this data is then critiqued by data that by race researchers who actually have our lived experiences, who are Black folks that are Black or racialized folks that are actually doing this work and have the lived experiences added to the academic experiences that they also have, in order to build new ways of understanding our systems and new ways of building our healthcare systems that are informed not only academically, but also like through the lived experiences, as I had said before.
Mm-hmm. And by the lived experiences of like no one else could provide that, right?
Exactly.
And I think it's interesting. I'm sort of circling back a little bit to the idea of, medical professionals in Canada flying blind without the data, and this idea of just having one set of data, and it all sort of, in my mind anyway, it ties back to this idea of like in Canada particularly of being like, well, it's okay here, we're doing fine, we don't need to be, you know, we're not racist, we don't need to be specifically looking at how all of this works, right?
Yeah. I mean, what we like reference is the fact that if we don't know what the trends and the data says, we don't know which communities get hit the hardest. Mm. How do we know if we have, for example, a crisis in healthcare that specifically have to do with Black people if we don't see it? Like you said, it goes back to the All Lives Matter argument. Like the way that I see online, some folks, the analogy that has been used is that like if there's a fire and there's a fire at one house, you wouldn't call firefighters to come and have their hoses out on every single house on the block. You'd have it on that one house because that one house is on fire, right? Like that is what we're looking at right now. We need to identify which communities could be hit the hardest or have been hit the hardest by COVID, not only through the health aspects, but like through
systemic racism, inequality.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to make sure that we're targeting those communities to make sure that that the aid is going to the right people and to the right places.
And I do think that that's really going to help once we, if we were to implement race-based data, at least we would be able to see and have a starting point.
Oh yeah, you're not flying blind.
Yeah.
it seems very simple.
And Jesse, I think along with the All Lives Matter argument, another thing that ends up being a barrier when we're demanding this information is that we don't have a big Black population in BC. At least that's according to a lot of people, right? We don't see the same same centralization of like Black communities in BC as you might see in like some parts of the US. However, according to a 2016 census, there are 43,000 British Columbians in BC currently. And that might not be a huge population, but 43,000 is still a lot of people to ignore, right? That's what we're trying to emphasize. That's still a lot of people to not be paying attention to.
Yeah, it's five times the size of the town I grew up in, right? Like it's a lot of people to be ignoring.
It's a lot. And it may only be, like, I think it's just a little less than 1% of the BC population, but 43,000 people is a lot of people. And
with unique experiences who are already being systemically missed or not being cared for by the system already, right?
People but we're not all starting at the same place either.
Exactly.
And I think that this what is being asked for here is sort of an equity seeking solution, or a solution that looks to try to provide people with the supports that they need to have a fair chance, which is not currently does not seem to be the case.
Exactly. Yeah.
If people want to take action on this particular item, the push for disaggregated race-based data collection in BC, what are their best options?
Well, one of their best options would be just to share the letter that we had written already. Sharing that and really getting the word out, I think will be a really, really good first step. Secondly, obviously, what we always recommend is to do your research. Do your research. Look into other places that may or may not have race-based data, and look at what exactly is learned by academics, and not only that, but folks on the ground, folks that are doing the community work. Doing research really goes a long way in informing why this push is needed to be had, and just keeping yourself informed, keeping a part of the conversation. I don't know, Susan, do you want to add a little bit?
Yeah, this is going to be a long conversation that we have, not just in this moment, but just keeping yourself in the loop.
Yeah.
Right, and I think that it's also important, as you said, this is a long fight. It's not a long conversation. Even once, fingers crossed, COVID-19 is at least under some degree of control, it's not the need for race-based data does not disappear. Right. Well, I feel like that's a pretty good place to leave it, unless there's anything else that you two would like to touch on.
No, I think that's all that we are good with today. Just coming back to the GoFundMe, sharing the GoFundMe really, really goes a long way. Our original target, we have completely hit it out of the park, but there's still a lot of work to be done, and that support through our GoFundMe is really, really appreciated. That again, I'll share with you the GoFundMe and the group that Black folks can go to join the mutual aid network that we're creating. Great. On Facebook.
And we'll post that on the CJSF website.
Yeah. But just back to the GoFundMe.
Yep. Great. Well, thank you, Ella and Aria.
Thank you.
And I will, I'll talk to you again soon, I'm sure.
We hope so. Thank you so much, Jesse.
Okay. Have a nice rest of your day.
Bye-bye.
Something in my melanin, I come from that resilience, make a difference. Something in my melanin. Give me rise, give me shine, give me high. There's something in my melanin, rooted in color. Make it that difference. Something in my melon you don't like. Something in my melon don't sit right. I know my work, it ain't in your vines. It's different than the story. Yes, in my lines. That black pat, little one, you see? Little one, you see that? Beauty in your brown, beauty in your black, beauty in your words, beauty in your smile, beauty in your voice, beauty in your hair, beauty in your curls, beauty in your eyes, beauty in your melanin, beauty in your melanin. Something in we stepping for walls and those who fought. Lost souls, we keep blighting. Fighting for rights, we keep fighting. Surround myself with peace in my bubble. Working hard in my blood and hustle. Show them the way we do that, the way we do that. Hey, rapping it till we free. We jamming, protesting and dancing till we free. We singing, we marching and shouting till we free. Here is something for my, till we free. My melanin, my melanin. Something in my melanin keeps me stomping and fighting. Something in my melanin gives me all that I need. Something in my melanin. Something in my melanin.
Jacquet, and I am the Manager of Knowledge and Practice at the Morris J. Wask Center for Dialogue at SFU.
Thanks for joining me, Elodie. And maybe to get started, we could just talk about like what prompted the creation of the Guide Beyond Inclusion, Equity in Public Engagement.
Absolutely. So the Morris J. Wask Center for Dialogue is kind of a think and do tank at SFU, and we do focus a lot on public engagement and dialogue. Mm-hmm. Public engagement meaning here all the ways in which institutions and governments look to citizens and residents to provide input or advice into diverse areas that may affect their lives. So if you think about everything from consulting the public around where new green spaces should go, or bigger, deeper discussions on policy, such as what we could do through a citizens assembly, for example. So we're very interested in all the aspects of public engagement, from the simplest of these engagements to the very complex ones. So we do quite a bit of research on these topics, and about 2 years ago, we were commissioned by the International Association for Public Participation to write a research paper on how we could think about inclusion in public engagement. As you know, inclusion, equity, and diversity are kind of buzzwords right now. Everybody wants to do this, and it seemed like a lot of organizations that were engaging in public engagement were really looking to be a bit more diverse, be a bit more inclusive, and so they commissioned this paper. So we went ahead and did a literature review, we did a couple of interviews, we wrote a very simple, about 10-page paper with some principles inclusive public engagement. And why we chose principles is because each engagement is very contextual. So if you think about engagement as a spectrum, in some cases we engage communities to inform them about something, and in some cases we engage them to co-create something with them. And obviously, you know, this can be on a wide variety of subjects. So it's very hard to come up with a blueprint for how to do inclusion well. So we proposed a series of principles. And as we were finishing these principles, we realized there's so much more to this than what we had managed to put in that paper. And we were very fortunate that at the time, there was a little bit of funding available to us through an endowment that we have at the center. And that enabled us to then launch into a year and a half of research with focus groups, again, more literature reviews, more interviews, a peer review, and a couple of dialogues that we led with different communities, including with the Open Government Summit that happened in Ottawa last May, and that was with international practitioners. So we went through this whole process and came up with a new and revised list of principles. And then we went back to our internal community at SFU, you know, colleagues, folks who do engagement at the university level, and we wanted to test this out with them. So we sent them the document, asked them for their feedback, and to our great surprise, they actually liked it, but they also pointed out some things they thought were missing from there, including a stronger emphasis on the term equity and what that meant, and also a stronger emphasis on the particular area of Indigenous engagement. So we went back to the drawing board, underwent a couple more focus groups and refined these things, went through a peer review again, and the guide that you see today is the result of that. But again, it's not a finished product per se. Our intention with this is to spark a conversation, maybe do a little bit of provocation. And hopefully what we want to see is that this guide will evolve over time, that these principles will change and start including more things that are necessary or that emerge as being necessary as we go through this. So that's a little bit of the backstory. Sorry, that was a bit long. Sorry.
No, that's great. There's a lot to dig into there. And one of the things that just pops to mind is, you know, you, in the process of creating this guide for public engagement, you had to do some public engagement, right?
Yes, and, absolutely.
and I mean, then you also talk about, you know, this being the beginning of a process and it being constantly refined, and that then just reflects one of the principles, which is the commitment to ongoing learning and improvement. And I, so how much were you having to constantly revise, your strategy for engagement on this project as you learned more about it, or did you just sort of like pick your strategy at the beginning and then circle back once you had sort of completed a phase?
So one important thing to know about the particular team that worked on this is that all of us are actually identified from different so-called minorities.
Okay.
So there's a number of women of color. We all, you know, have different personal agendas with this topic. And I think the way we've always approached this work is working in a very close partnership with the different communities we try to engage with. So a lot of this work was highly collaborative and really looking at co-creating this content with the different communities we were talking to. So that was very important from the beginning. So that also meant at times shifting our focus or looking at new aspects that were coming up and integrating them. So it was a very iterative process, and it's probably why it probably took longer than most of our usual research processes. It was highly participative and, as I said, collaborative. So of course that takes time, and you have to adjust, you have to make room, you have to cede power at certain times, and you learn along the way that it's okay. It's okay to take your time. It's okay to be iterative, and it's okay to relinquish some control.
I think those are very
powerful messages, and also sort of difficult things for, like, they sort of run counter to the standard paradigm of how things should get done, I feel, just in terms of, you know, there being a timeline for everything and everything having to get done real quickly and in the most efficient way possible. How do you see organizations and institutions tackling that sort of shift in perspective in terms of, like, having to focus on doing things the right way, regardless of the fact that it might be longer or harder of a process?
Well, I think the pandemic that we're dealing with right now is a really good example in that it is forcing us to do things differently. Hmm. It's actually forcing us to slow down and really think about how we do engagement and why we do engagement. And I think it's also bringing to light a number of inequities in our societies. And, you know, it's crystallizing some of that in a really deep way. So I'm actually very optimistic that from the conversations that I'm having with practitioners right now, there's really a desire to do this better and to do this in a more community-oriented fashion and less in a transactional manner. So again, looking at engagement not so much as a way to tick a box and obtain buy-in for projects, but more as a building of ongoing relationships. Because I think a lot of organizations right now are realizing that there's a deficit in trust. There's a deficit in that sense of participation and belonging in communities. And if we don't repair that, we're in for a lot of trouble. So regardless of what institution we're in, right?
Yeah.
I think there's a realization right now that is coming to light because we're in the midst of this, you know, extraordinary situation. But it is focusing that aspect that we need to do this better. And we really need to step away from that. I'm going to throw a word out here that may sound a bit pejorative, but we need to move away from a capitalistic perspective on how we do engagement and really focus more on equity and on community. And if we don't do that, unfortunately, it shows. And I think people do not want to engage. They do not trust the engagement process. And they don't feel like their participation gives them any agency in how the decisions are being made.
Yeah, well, I think time and time again, you can see that if like you're saying, the sort of public engagement is just a tack on to tick a box, people see through that, right? And people expect to be heard and engaged with on the issues that that affect them more than ever now.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think, you know, you can't take for granted the level of participation we currently have. You have to keep showing people that you're accountable, that you're actually really listening to them, that you're taking into account their advice. And you have to communicate really openly and transparently. And that's something we've heard time and time again through this research. Those aspects of accountability, of transparency, of honesty, and of just being really authentic in how you engage with folks. That's very important. And I think we know this on a very personal level. We don't want to engage with somebody who's inauthentic or who comes across as having a hidden agenda. Mm-hmm. So on an institutional level, it's very similar. And we also know from research, for example, that more and more folks feel like they're disengaged from their own participation in democratic activities as a whole. So this does tell us that if there's a crisis in that sense of agency, there's a crisis in the sense of belonging to society, something's wrong. We have to change how we do things.
Yeah, well, I mean, the model that you have presented seems like a much fairer and more equitable way of coming up with plans and including voices. I know working at the radio station, which is a nonprofit built around trying to center marginalized voices and engage with communities that historically don't have access to media in the same way. Like, all of these questions, all of the principles that are in there are things that we're navigating every day. And I wonder, like, you know, you said it doesn't really matter the size of the institution or whatever. do you see there being a particular group of organizations or institutions that this is more useful for, or is it just pretty widely applicable?
It is meant, because it's principles-based, it is meant to be as widely applicable as possible. But from a personal standpoint, I think the institutions that should really look at this more are the larger ones that have a history of not including marginalized voices or upholding systems that further marginalize people. And I think it is a very difficult conversation to have at an institutional level, because we don't like looking at ourselves under that light. Mm-hmm. And we don't like admitting that maybe we've been, you know, complicit in erasing certain voices or keeping certain parts of our community away or taking away their agency in some decisions. We don't like to see ourselves in that light. But I think we have an obligation to do that work and in a sense to recenter the voices that have been left out for so long.
I know you've talked about this being a living document and a sort of an ongoing process. Do you have any broader vision for the legacy of this document?
Yes. So the thing we're working on right now is we're collecting case studies. Because one of the things we found in the research was that to convince decision makers to do this work, you had to present them with concrete ways in which people have done this before that have worked. Mm-hmm. So we're collecting a lot of case studies right now. We're going to be publishing them regularly on our webpage and then publishing a case study book probably next year once we have like a large number of them. We're also producing an international version of the guide, which will have slightly adapted language for some other countries, and will profile international case studies as well. And one thing we're looking for right now is some champions to take this on, try it out, and see how it goes. And what we're hoping to do is provide our institutional ability to support organizations to do some evaluation on this work. So again, you know, this might not happen immediately, obviously, in the crisis we're in, but we're hoping, you know, in the years to come, a couple of organizations will really take this on seriously and will allow us to come and observe and evaluate and work with them iteratively to get better at this. And then we're hoping community will also, you know, let us know if they think we got this right, or if we're missing pieces, or if things need to be added. So we're really looking forward to continuing to interact with the different groups that we've worked with, but also with others who might be interested in this. And in the SFU community, that also includes all the folks that we know do participatory research, for example, or community-based research, because we're also interested in how universities engage with their communities and what role does equity play in that sphere? Because we also know research hasn't always been very equitable with the communities they tend to use for, you know, the purposes of research.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned getting feedback from the community. Earlier today, we're recording Thursday, you had sort of the webinar public launch of the guide. Did you learn anything, or were you surprised by anything that happened during the webinar today, or was it all sort of as expected?
I think this was a first, you know, touch point. I think what was really interesting to me is how people asked the really tough questions, like how are you going to push this through a lens of liberation, you know, rather than just a lens of public engagement? And that's a tough question to answer. And what we're hoping is to hear more of that and to also be held accountable by community who might tell us, you know, you have some nice language in here, you know, you talk a good talk, but are you walking the talk? Mm-hmm. So that's what I'm hoping to hear back from, mostly from the community partners that we work with, but also other colleagues at SFU that I know will give us a call if, you know, doing something that's stepping out of the line or not doing this in a good way. So yeah, so I'm putting the call out, like really, if anyone wants to take this on or give us a call or email us, we're really open to that. And we want to keep the communication lines open with different folks, for sure.
Well, and it's important to be willing to engage with the difficult conversations, because that is sort of the heart of all of this, is being willing to put in the work and listen and engage, right?
Absolutely. And I think this is something that's very near and dear to my heart, because I am a person of color myself, and I'm a woman. I identify as a woman. And, that aspect of needing to push organizations to have those hard discussions, we cannot relent on that. We have to push it as much as we can. There are still too many voices that are left out, that are not being heard, or that are being marginalized or harmed. And I think, if anybody's been watching the news lately, we've had so many examples of how that harm is playing out. Mm-hmm. And it breaks my heart. It breaks my heart every day. Yesterday I was having a chat with some friends about recent events in the U.S. and we can't let go of this. This is an ongoing work that needs to happen, and we all need to do our part. If we don't, things are not going to get better.
Absolutely. Well, Elodie, thank you for taking the time to join me today. Is there anything else you think people should know about either Beyond Inclusion or other work that you do?
Just take a look at the guide and give us your feedback. Our contact is on the back of the guide, so you should be able to get in touch with us pretty easily. And I'm really pleased to be on the radio with CGSF. I myself did work for a little while in community radio, so always love to hear about small radio stations still being alive.
Yeah, welcome back.
No. Dreams.
I hope one day my dreams will come true. Then with the stars and say, I made it. Is that what it means to say made? Or is it just a concept of man-made criteria? We follow the pattern of other bacteria.
Be